issues it's been concerned about it. That thread concerns a basic philosophical cleavage between those who believe in centralized power over the individual, allegedly produce some type of perfect society, and those who believe the individual can only develop to his full potential by being genuinely free. Now, genuine freedom is not a type of free for all, but an acceptance of the fact that there are absolutes which, if understood and obeyed, make for greater freedom. We might just ponder for a moment and consider that famous statement, in whose service is perfect freedom. Perhaps we could spell that out by saying that if we accept the authority of God as the ultimate absolute, then that makes genuine freedom possible. In other words, we cannot alter reality. We can discover reality, and we can obey reality. One of the absolutes we've been dealing with, and it runs right throughout history, has been what we might call the will to power. Wherever there have been human beings, the will to power has existed. It can and has expressed itself in many different ways. We can go right back to Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was the first to try and establish, you might say, a world order. He made use primarily of physical or military power. But today, power is exercised in other ways. But the objective is just the same, the will to power. As the late C.H. Douglas pointed out, the Industrial Revolution, which is now expanding into something called the Technological Revolution, has merely magnified the nature of the problem concerning the will to power. The development of the Industrial Civil Revolution, leading then to the Technological Revolution, made it possible for the individual to be freed in a way transcending everything that happened in the past. The great tragedy is, however, that this explosion of knowledge concerning how power can be used, industrial power, the technology, has been manipulated to produce exactly the opposite result, and that is centralized power over the individual. And the result of this application of this policy in this type of philosophy has produced disaster everywhere. The developments which have taken place since the development of the Industrial Revolution have been dominated by centralized control of the financial system. And so we hear a great deal of talk today about new world orders, as if this is a new idea. But the idea itself is again as old as man. It is an absolute. It's the idea of a group of elitists, irrespective of what you call them, who believe if they have enough power, they can plan the perfect society. We can go right back to the famous Greek philosopher Plato, who believed the perfect state could be produced if elitists like himself had the power to impose their allegedly superior knowledge. Many other examples could be given. In one sense, Australia is a scene providing an example of what we can call the revolt against reality. That revolt which refused to accept absolutes, which believes that man is self-sufficient. Man does not need to obey any truths greater than himself. He is the source of all truth. The famous Jewish philosopher, whom I've already quoted, Dr. Oscar Leamy, made the rather pertinent comment that idealism is the enemy of the real. The idealist is a person who conceives of how things ought to work, if only he had enough power, and then proceeds to try and do that. In one sense, whether called communists, fascists, whatever you call these people, they are really idealists. They believe there's no greater truth than what they themselves can conceive. And so here we see the root of the tragedy concerning the human drama. It is a conflict between these two points of view. And the League of Rights has been right at the center of this debate. And its stand is quite clear for those that wish to understand it. Now, in the case of Australia, historically, I'd suggest that if we look back only a few years, in fact, we can start from 1972 onwards, when the Whitlam government came to office, with people like Whitlam, obviously great idealists who believed they were elitists and could plan for that new site of world order in Australia. We've seen this philosophy concerning centralized power express itself through all the major political parties. 1972 produced the explosions associated with the Whitlam government. We move forward from the Whitlam government to the Fraser government. Nothing changed, nothing basically changed, the same philosophy undergirded what the government was attempting to do. And we move on then to the Hawke government. And again, exactly the same thing took place, a revulsion against the politicians, which in essence meant nothing really was changed concerning the power structure. We merely changed the public relations men, or we might call them the managers. Nothing changed at all. The nature of the problem continued. And so it doesn't matter what you call this type of planning. You can use whatever labels you like, but you don't change reality by putting a different label on it. It's rather like saying that if you call strychnine icing sugar, you can take that with absolute safety. Or you can call centralized planning by the name of democratic socialism, or you can even call it liberalism, you call it what you like. But the undergirding philosophy always produces the same result. And so from 1972 onwards, we can see that Australia has been on a path. And to pick up again the thread, we need to recall what took place and what has taken place. 1972 was the year in which, you might say, the Australian government, the Whitlam government, officially accepted the philosophy undergirding a new manifestation of this point of view called economic rationalism. That's one of the new buzzwords, but the reality is just the same. And in the case of economic rationalism, those who conceived of this idea, believe that if we can globalize our problems, internationalize our problems, and ensure that our economies are meshed with the economies of the rest of the world, that in some way international competitiveness will produce greater efficiency, and that we'll all be better off. It became known not only as economic rationalism and globalism and internationalism, but of course we all heard of that cliche called the level playing field. Except the level playing field obviously was far from level, as witnessed by looking at what took place from 1972 onwards. Now, the first thing that took place was that we started to close down Australian industries. The theory was that what those industries used to produce might perhaps be produced much more efficiently in some other part of the world, particularly in Asia, and that we could benefit from that. This theory conveniently overlooked a number of other factors. One being that this means that the standard of living in Australia must be reduced down to the level of Asian workers. It's not a question of whether we're more efficient in the sense of our technologies any better. It's simply that you are saying that Australian workers must be prepared to accept lower wages to compete with Asian workers. Now, we have seen then a steady decline in the real standard of living in Australia. The theorists have overlooked, again, part of reality, namely that, of course, economic centralization produces social problems. It produces human problems and many other problems. And the real cost cannot be measured always in terms of finance, but we must look at social dislocation. We must look at growing unemployment in a country like Australia. Unemployment, which of course has also been stimulated by the introduction of technology, but the spin-off from unemployment is the result of this false philosophy, overlooks the human factor, and eventually, if carried far enough, we finish with a type of underclass, an underclass in which violence and much else takes root and expresses itself in the type of events we've seen in recent years in Australia. This all adds to the real costs of a nation. Greater police forces, more social welfare organisations, and much else. So please note, this is the direction which we have been moving from 1972 until the present time. It's become the major issue in Australian politics. And as the centenary of the League of Rights, first centenary, is celebrated, we are observing that our predictions concerning what would take place have been borne out, dramatically borne out, tragically borne out. It simply does not work. Now, there are other aspects of this question we've got to get our minds around for the future of Australia. The first is, of course, that that has led to a philosophy which has again been promoted, first by Whitlam government, Labor government. You'll recall that Mr. Keating's government was particularly strong on it. But Australia is part of Asia. We must now join with Asia. That is our destiny. We changed the public relations men. But we found the new public relations men, instead of proposing a different policy with a different philosophy, they merely said they could implement this same program much better and more efficiently than their predecessors. In other words, undergirding the change of political leaders has been the same philosophy. We must become part of Asia. Now, the implications of this for the future of Australia is quite horrendous. We might just spend a few minutes reflecting on this, because it is linked with the question of the future of Australia, which, of course, the League of Rights is concerned about. The first thing we need to stress is that Australia is not part of Asia in any realistic sense. We are a part of that history which flows out of Europe. You see, real history is not simply a one of geography. It's important, but it's a question of what stream of history do you come from? Where are the roots of your history? And the roots of Australia really go back not only into Europe, but a particular part of Europe, namely what today is called the United Kingdom. Much as it is denied, and I want to stress that because we've got to look at that, that's where our roots are. Now, if you tear people from their roots, then they're obviously rootless, and they don't know where they're going, and they can't know where they're going. So the whole subject of this Asian question is of the greatest importance for the future of Australia. And in fact, we might see the future of the world, because the Asians have merely adopted the gross materialism of the West, applied in a more vigorous manner to their own communities, and lacking the type of philosophical roots that we've had, they're producing problems of an even greater magnitude than we produce here. We could spend some time looking at that. It's not surprising that those societies have become increasingly violent societies. Pollution's become an enormous problem, and much else. The other point we've got to get our minds around is, of course, what's happened to politics themselves. Now, as I've said already in this series of talks, British representative government was more than just counting heads. It was concerned with the representation of all interests in a society, that a society consists of different parts, and those parts together make up the whole. Also based on an undergirding philosophy that the safest place for power is decentralised power. So in the case of Australia, if you study its constitutional developments, which the League has stressed time and time again, its roots are in the British concept, which, if you go back over history, has been praised by many, many great thinkers outside Britain. The concept of British constitutional government is one of those unique contributions to civilization which in this country we inherited. To break from that is a very serious question. Now, the modern party system has taken us a long way from that original concept of representative government. Some perceptive thinkers perceived the nature of the problem long ago, far back into the last century. A couple of distinguished members of the House of Commons, Hilaire Belloc and Cecil Chesterton, actually resigned their position because they said the party system even then was starting to be too dominant and the original concept of the free deliberative assembly was being destroyed. Well, how much worse is the position today? We moved after the First World War A most distinguished man, no less than the former Lord Chief Justice of England, Lord Hewitt, wrote a book trying to warn people. He called it The New Despotism. And he pointed out representative government was being undermined by this new type of despotism. The delegation of power to the non-elected official who governed with regulations and decrees. There was the progressive watering of what we call the common law, even interfering with such common law rights as once was accepted without question, that, for example, a man's home is his castle. That famous poem, many will recall, that not even the king could enter. It may be humble, it didn't matter how humble, the wind may blow through it, and the rain may leak in through the roof, but not even the king himself could enter without the permission of the person who owned it. How far we've removed ourselves from that, and we've seen that progressive erosion. After the Second World War, another distinguished jurist, Professor Keaton, later who became a judge, wrote another classic, you might say a sequel to The New Despotism, he called The Passing of Parliament. And he drew attention to this problem of the desire of the individual to exercise some control over his own affairs with progressively less effect. The fact that people were voting simply masked the real problem. The individual was not in the position to exercise effective representation or have effective representation. And this is a feature now of the modern world. That's the great problem that one of the League of Rights campaigns has been devoted to try and regenerate that system, perhaps along the lines of the Swiss system, the initiative referendum and recall, or some type of elector's veto, so that the elector has got some say and feels that he can have a say. It's this feeling of helplessness that's had such disastrous social effects. And these are one of the questions which I believe the future has got to deal with. The subject of representative government. In the case of Australia, it's clear. We have the roots of genuine representative government if we go back to the undergirding philosophy of our federal constitution, the decentralisation of power, power close to the people, and the sovereignty of the states. All governments have assaulted that concept. This is one of the great battlefields, and again the League has been at the centre of this. Associated with this program, this grandiose progress of making Australia part of some new world order and part of Asia, is that other fad called multiculturalism. Now the real meaning of multiculturalism is, of course, multi means many cultures. Again, we fly in the face of reality. There's no part of the world where we can demonstrate that multicultural groups can live harmoniously together. We can provide many examples where they can't. In fact, we've seen this since the breakup of the old Soviet Empire. We have seen it in Europe, the attempt to impose centralized control and call all the people in Western Europe Europeans, and they've all got to accept the same program. The more you impose that centralized program, the more the revolt, the more the friction. And so in Australia, multiculturalism has become a tremendous problem which the League of Rights has warned about and stressed, if it's pursued, is certainly going to worsen social cohesion in the society and produce more friction. Then there's the question of immigration, which is all linked with this concept of the global world, in which anybody can move anywhere at any time as they're uprooted, Which means you have large numbers of people with no roots, rootlessness, and you have violence and you have conflict. These are all questions which now threaten the future of Australia, and the League has warned about them. And regretfully, events have confirmed what the League has to say. We have a lot of buzzwords to try and offset any criticism. You may be called a racist or much else, but like the term anti-Semitism, that's simply a swear word that's tried for the purpose of stifling genuine discussion about the differences in the groups of people in the world. And the fact is, they're going to live harmoniously together, we must accept reality. These are now basic issues facing Australia, if Australia is to survive, not geographically, but survive as that type of nation which was conceived by those who built this nation as an extension of Western Christian civilization. And on that point, it is appropriate that we might recall that after 50 years of activity by the League, that we should draw attention to how far that retreat from Western civilization in Australia has progressively gained momentum. A number of eminent, distinguished authorities have drawn attention to the fact that what we call Western civilization is dying. It's hard for some people to grasp that because physically they still see the world around them, but they overlook the fact that civilization is not just simply a material phenomenon. Civilization is what we might call the incarnation of undergirding values. And once you destroy that value system, then the whole structure progressively disintegrates. So if you take a trip today to modern Greece, you may look at the great Acropolis and the remaining parts of Greek architecture and say, well, that's marvelous. But you don't make the mistake of saying that because part of the architecture is still there, the Greek civilization is still there. It died 2,000 years ago. All that's left are the physical manifestations. The same with Western Europe. As we move around, we can see the great cathedrals and much else still standing as replicas of a different type of society. But the values that produced those cathedrals and much else have all died or been allowed to perish. What remains is being progressively diluted. So our parliamentary system is not the same as it was when it was originally evolved. And these are questions which those who are concerned about the future of civilization have got to direct their attention to. And the League does that. You may well ask, well, over 50 years, what has the League achieved? Apart from participating in a number of campaigns and political campaigns, economic campaigns and much else, what has the League actually achieved? Perhaps I can summarise that by saying that it has held high through this very violent period in human history, this last 50 years. It's held high that torch of truth and freedom, and it has brought many generations to an understanding of the roots of the society out of which they have developed. Several generations of Australians have been put in touch with their real roots, their philosophical roots, their cultural roots, and we might even say their religious roots. And the League has pointed out how they have been progressively robbed of an understanding. Their children have been robbed. The educational system's been perverted. What the League has done is to put large numbers of Australians in touch with their roots. And that's an important point to think about, because it's only when we grasp our roots and where we've come from can we talk realistically about what obviously is a question of regenerating. Now, if we don't know what our roots are and where they've come from and the nature of those roots, how can we talk about regenerating those roots? And that means realistically a return to a more basic consideration of our Christian roots from an historic point of view. What did those roots bring to the human drama? They brought a new concept concerning the nature of the individual. For the first time in human history, every individual was regarded as precious. Every individual belonged to what you might call the divine order of things. This was a revolutionary concept up until then. It was a complete break. What we've got to do is to go back and pick up those broken threads so that we can regenerate. Touch again that sap that once fed our civilization. Unless we do that, then how can we say Australia has any future as a free, sovereign nation? If we go down the road of tearing up our institutions, destroying representative government, imposing multiculturalism, how then can we ensure that the future is secure for Australians yet to come? The essence, as I see it, is very, very clear. It's two philosophical concepts, two cleavages concerning the human being, the human drama. And the essence comes back to that question of centralization of power. Every drive towards the centralization of power is at the expense of the divine individual. Every centralization of power drives the individual down the divine scale of existence and, taken far enough, reduces him just to the level of just a number, where he has no soul, his only role is to serve. That is where we stand at the moment. And you may say, well, what does the League suggest concerning this present crisis? The League suggests again that we go back again to our roots. The League is urging that we re-educate ourselves, that we attempt to bring to the attention of our young people that tremendous heritage, that so future generations can regenerate it. Some of you may recall that famous poem, it was famous one time, that came out of the First World War by the Canadian poet John McCrae in Flanders Field. You may recall those famous lines, the poppies grow. The line that I think is the one that has got the most essence in meaning for me is where we're urged with failing hands to pass on the torch. That is the role of the League of Rights, to uphold that torch which is on our symbol, the torch of truth, the torch of freedom. The League of Rights has not failed, I believe, to sustain that torch. It's kept it flickering at a time when other groups have been wiped out. It has equipped a growing number of Australians to take the time to face these questions and to consider them. It has urged them to face the truth that makes people free. And although Australia is only a small nation, let us remember that in history, as the great Roman civilization was going down, way out on the periphery, there was a very small movement. It's very small in numbers, almost only an asterisk as far as history is concerned at that stage. This new explosive idea, this new revelation concerning how men could live together more harmoniously. Christianity came from the periphery. It grew from the periphery. It grew from the grassroots. It came from relatively simple individuals prepared to humble themselves. So we might see Australia in this context. We are really, as part of the Western world, on the periphery in one sense. But because we're on the periphery, and because of the nature of our history, our potential from the point of view of economic and other development, then perhaps we might look back on those 50 years as a type of period of preparation for what is yet to come in the next period, the next 50 years. And although we're a small nation, perhaps we can make that contribution, such as Christianity grew from the periphery. And when real history is written, it may be recorded in those famous words of a great British Prime Minister, William Pitt, that we saved ourselves by our own exertions and the rest of the world by example. This is the challenge which the League of Rights believes now faces Australia, and believes that is the contribution we can make to the continuation of Western civilization.